whom I could always lean. A man's ambition with a woman's heart, 'tis an accursed lot. With the intellect I always have, always shall overcome. But that is not half the work. The life, oh my God, shall the life never be sweet? But I digress. I wish to discuss a further point of similarity between us. I have heard the editor of your newsletter stand up and beg for contributions. Well, do I know the editor's plea. In 1839, the Transcendentalist Club proposed the idea of a journal to be named The Dial, and since Emerson refused the position of editor, it fell to me. I described the journal to William Henry Channing as a perfectly free organ to be offered for the expression of individual thought and character. Each month, I was compelled to coax the Transcendentalists for articles, and even with that, I must needs provide the largest part of many issues myself. We wrote on literature, philosophy, and society. Our magazine received mixed reviews. The eminent Unitarian minister, Theodore Parker, blamed all the Dial's faults on the unusual gender of its editor, saying the chief thing wrong with the Dial was that it needed a beard. But among its supporters, the journal was gladly received. During my 2 years as editor, I strove for vitality rather than technical perfection. I did, however, manage to offend both Alcott and Thoreau by requesting revisions to their work. After this episode of my life, my writing assumed new forms. In the summer of 1843, when I was age 33, I undertook a great journey to the American Northwest, the ultimate ends of civilized existence, Milwaukee. I observed the wonder of Niagara Falls on my way and bemoaned the fact in 1843 that it was beginning to be surrounded by buildings for the accommodation of visiting tourists. My account, published under the title Summer on the Lakes, was more than a travelogue. I discussed themes of social issues which much occupied my thoughts. I'm glad to see that in your time you have activities of social action and that you have made progress in many areas, and yet in some ways you resemble still the world I knew. On my journey, I saw remnants of Indian tribes whose world was fast disappearing, and who, from proud keepers of the land, were reduced to sickly beggars. On my return, I took up abode in New York and published articles for Horace Greeley's New York Tribune. I visited prisons, poorhouses, and insane asylums. In my columns, I called for reform in attitude as well as in institutions. Around this time, I also published a book which stated the radical notion that all souls are equal, free, slave, Indian, white, male, and female. The book was entitled Woman in the 19th Century. In this book, I encouraged women to postpone marriage until they had developed a sense of themselves. I recommended that women be economically independent and not socially pressured to get married. I advocated that all professions be open to women. We would have every arbitrary barrier thrown down and have every path laid open to woman as freely as to man. If you ask me what offices women may fill, I reply, any. I do not care what case you put, let them be sea captains, if you will. Today you might say astronauts, but in my time, sea captains were the epitome of masculine adventure. People were shocked that a spinster of 34 years should discuss the sexual double standard as I did. Men were allowed total freedom because of their insatiable needs. Women were to be ignorant of such passions and unyielding to these insatiable men until they married, after which they must submit implicitly to their husbands. The least appearance of coldness in the wife is wicked, because liable to turn her husband's thoughts to illicit indulgence. Any transgressions by the husband thus became the fault of the wife. The educational system, I wrote a century and a half ago, must give girls as fair a field as boys, the level playing field. Too much is said of women being better educated so that they may become better companions and mothers for men. Not one man in a million can rise above the belief that woman was made for man. Each woman must lay aside all thought of being taught and led by men. Even the well-meaning males who seemed so glad to esteem women whenever they could would never in any extreme of despair wish they were women. After a century of reforms in education, suffrage, and law, I am sad to learn that this perception is still a barrier to true equality. For even in your time, what man would wish to be a woman? Yet man can never be truly free until woman is also. We are one. There is no wholly masculine man, no purely feminine woman. I will close by telling you of the happy ending and the tragic conclusion of my life story. In 1846, at the age of 36, I finally visited England, France, and at last, my beloved Italy, the country where I belonged. The Italians sympathized with my character and understood my organization as no other people did. They admired the ready eloquence of my nature and highly prized my intelligent sympathy with their sufferings. Here was a land of passion and grandeur, so different from the cold proprieties of New England. In this magical atmosphere, I experienced one day my own Italian adventure. Separated by accident from my traveling companions, I was rescued and accompanied by a charming young man who turned out to be an impoverished nobleman. He, like myself, cherished strong sympathies for the Republican movement in Italy, led by Mazzini, whom I had met and befriended in London. Perhaps it was the freedom from American conventions which allowed me to indulge in a happy liaison with my dear Giovanni Asoli. Scholars still debate whether he and I were quietly married before or after the birth of our son in the tumultuous year of 1848. I should not wish to spoil the debate by divulging the truth of the matter here today. I endured the siege of Rome and visited wounded soldiers in the hospital while sending dispatches to the New York Tribune. Thus, I became the first female war correspondent. As news of my marriage and child reached home, it was greeted with great disapproval. The very individuals who had censured me for not marrying and fulfilling my womanly role now denounced me as licentious. I had married a foreigner and under dubious circumstances. In my happiness, I ignored their opinions, but my idyll was not to last. My family's financial situation had improved but little, and my voyage had been financed through loans from a number of friends and relations. Although I had convinced Greeley to pay me twice the usual rate for my columns, I could no longer afford to remain abroad. Our voyage home on the small bark Elizabeth was ill-omened from the first. After a week at sea, the captain became ill. We were forced to harbor at Gibraltar, where he died of smallpox. My little son contracted this fearsome disease, and none save I believed he would survive. I refused to give up hope, and indeed he recovered. But on the morning of our arrival in New York Harbor, the first mate, who was now in charge, made a tragic miscalculation. The ship was driven onto a large sandbar off Long Island, pounded by huge waves. As light dawned, we could see figures on the beach, but all our lifeboats had been destroyed, and there was no way to reach us. Some passengers contrived to swim ashore with the assistance of wooden planks, but I refused to leave my child and could not bear him through the waves. That afternoon, when the tide came in, the ship broke up, and the rest of us were thrown overboard. Our bodies were never recovered, and neither was my manuscript for a book on the Italian Revolution. I was but 2 months past my 40th birthday. Emerson lamented, "I have lost in her my audience." The world lost as well a voice that would have contributed to the burgeoning women's movement. At the first National Women's Rights Convention in October of that very year, the delegates observed a moment of silence in memory of the woman to whom they had hoped to confide the leadership of the movement. Yet my voice has been carried on by others. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony wrote in their History of Woman's Suffrage, "Margaret Fuller possessed more influence upon the thought of American women than any woman previous to her time." I am proud to see as well that future Unitarians, such as you, carry on my voice in your quest for spiritual meaning, equality, and justice. We have time for some questions or comments. And I should mention, most of this is taken right from Margaret's writings, journals, diaries, letters, and books, except for those few things that I figured she would have said if she had been here today. Well, I know that, I know she spoke, She knew French, German, Italian, and worked on translations of Goethe and others, but you may know more than me there. Also, a descendant of Margaret Fuller, a great-great-grandnephew, I think, was Buckminster Fuller, who you may have heard of. Oh, I was going to mention one reason why we haven't heard much about Margaret. I think at the time she was very ahead of her time, but after her death, her family and friends seemed to sort of soften her. They referred to her as Mrs. Ossoli and made it seem that she was less controversial than she was, and I think she was only rediscovered recently as to what she really said. But right, the husband and child. And there was the child, in fact, they had sent the baby away to the country supposedly to be safer because the revolution was going on. And, you know, people did sometimes send their children out to wet nurses and so on. But the people who were supposed to be watching the child were not feeding him well, and that was a whole, was a very difficult thing for Margaret to be separated from the child and go back and find him not well taken care of. But all three of them were drawn to these. But there was a lot of overlap between abolition, temperance. The original article that the book Woman in 19th Century was developed from an earlier article in the Dial called The Great Lawsuit, and that had this idea that all people were equal, free and slave, man and woman, and so on. And Margaret didn't seem to devote herself entirely to one thing, such as temperance or abolition. She felt that these causes were related. She didn't particularly go out on the circuit. I have a feeling that some of that came even a bit later, because this was only 1850, that it was a bit early for some of these causes. I don't think that she attended regularly, just like Emerson. They felt that they had gone beyond the church. And I think it's interesting that some of it is the same. At least in my former church, we had the same thing where people said, well, this place is too intellectual. People just get up and give a talk. And we're looking for more connection. And this is what Emerson and Margaret said. And they had this little group. It was almost like a professor and graduate students, where Emerson was the father of them all, and here was Thoreau and Alcott and Margaret and others, and Hawthorne, and Emerson was the one who got Thoreau out of jail, I think, and all sort of, he was actually making a living from his writings and therefore could help out some of these lesser knowns, but they were kind of like a group of hippies or something, you know, on the fringe of society. And I found out after I started doing this, there is a woman who has done this professionally, who has a one-woman show of Margaret Fuller, which I'm sure is wonderful. And she did a thing with another male actor where they did letters and correspondence between Emerson and Fuller, which I'm sure was very entertaining, because their relationship is sort of ambiguous. Well, they both had large egos, so that would be very difficult. And you could see how Emerson could never marry someone like that. He wanted to marry housewife and someone who would admire him, and Emerson and Fuller had great discussions sometimes on points they didn't agree on, but they both enjoyed that very much, that they had someone to bounce their ideas off. And actually, there's a nearby connection in on the trip that Margaret took, which I guess Milwaukee was the end of civilization. That's why she that's as far as she got. But she went through northern Illinois and the Rock River Valley. There's a town called Oregon, Illinois, and that's, she described that as being as beautiful as anything in that she had ever seen. And that's actually nearby where my in-laws live. So, but that was still the fringes of civilization, and the Indian tribes were still around. That hymn made me think of Margaret because she had a fierce unrest and stinging discontent, and she spent her time doing laundry and so on, and when she had so much to offer. And our closing words are actually a responsive reading in the hymnal by Margaret, which is number 575. And this is something that she wrote in the 1830s. So you can see how far ahead of her time she was. A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come.
Man and woman may regard one another as brother and sister, able both to appreciate and
new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come.
What a woman needs is not as a woman to act or rule, but as a nature to grow, and an intelligence to discern the soul to live freely and unimpeded, to unfold such powers as are given her.
A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come. A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come.
We would have every arbitrary barrier thrown down. We would have every path laid open to woman as freely as to man.
Were this done, we believe a divine energy would pervade nature to a degree unknown in the history of former ages.